the body of a man floating face down. He was clothed, but the t-shirt he wore was torn off and held to his body by the collar only. The rest of it waved in the water like a white flag of surrender. The divers were struggling as they tried to roll the body onto a rescue stretcher attached to a cable extending down from the chopper. "Salton Sea," Lourdes said. "This was 2 hours ago. They spotted the body on a flyover at dawn." Bosch leaned down, careful not to spill his coffee, to look more closely at the screen and the body. "That the second Russian?" Lourdes asked. Before Bosch could answer, he noticed that they had been joined by Sisto, who was looking over Bella's other shoulder. "Clothes look the same," Bosch said. "From what I can remember, gotta be him." "I asked them to send us a close-up of the face once they have the body at the coroner's," Lourdes said. "That would wrap things up nice," Sisto said. "On our case, at least." "Sure would," Lourdes added. "Why don't we all go into the war room for updates and to figure out who's doing what on this today?" "Sounds like a plan," Sisto said. Lourdes got up and called to Trevino and Luzon. Bosch could still smell the breakfast he had missed lingering in the air of the war room. The four detectives took seats around the table, and Trevino joined as well. Bosch spoke first.
Before we start divvying up paperwork and stuff, I'm here to do what I need to do and be available for any follow-up with other agencies. But as you all know, I have a thing in court Wednesday morning with my reputation and possible future with this department on the line, so I need some prep time for that today. There are some things I have to do, and they can't wait."
"Understood, Harry," Trevino said. "And if there's anything we can do here to help with that, you let me know. I've talked to the chief, and speaking for him and everybody in this room, we are behind you 100%. We know what kind of detective and person you are." Bosch could feel his face turning red with embarrassment. In all his years in law enforcement, he had never heard such accolades from a supervisor. "Thanks, Cap," he managed to say. They settled down and got to the business at hand, starting with Lourdes summarizing a report she had gotten that morning from Agent Hovan on the DEA's activities since the previous afternoon. She reported that the encampment down near Slab City had been raided and shut down. The addicted inhabitants were evacuated to the naval base in San Diego, where they were being medically evaluated before being offered placement in pro bono rehab programs. Lourdes reported that the DEA had also shut down the clinic in Pacoima and arrested the men operating it, along with a physician of record, Ephraim Herrera. Among those arrested was the driver of the van. Though he was suspected of being the getaway driver in the Farmacia murders, he had so far been charged under federal law only for taking part in a continuing criminal organization. From there, report writing, follow-up inquiries, and notifications were distributed among the detectives, with Bosch getting a full pass. Lourdes and Luzon were assigned to go to the federal detention facility downtown and take a shot at interviewing the driver about the Farmacia shootings, a task all of those in the room predicted would be fruitless. 15 minutes later, Bosch was crossing the street to the old jail, carrying his third cup of coffee of the day. He noticed that the TV truck was now gone, and he guessed that the reporter and crew had been shined on by Chief Valdez. A joint press conference on the case would be held at 3 p.m. at the station with DEA and state medical board officials. It would be announced that the double murder at La Farmacia Familia had been solved and that the suspects were dead, provided that Bosch was able later to identify the body recovered that morning from the Salton Sea as the second Russian. Because Bosch had worked undercover on the case, he had an out and would not be required to appear at the press conference. Besides his coffee, Bosch carried a file containing copies of documents that had been pulled together overnight on the case. The one he was most interested in studying was the Interpol report on the man he had killed on the plane. Once in his cell in the old jail, he sat down behind his makeshift desk and opened the file. It turned out the man he killed was not technically Russian, though it was clear from the Interpol data that he grew up speaking the language. Fingerprints had identified him as Dmitry Sluchek, born in 1980 in Minsk, Belarus. He had served time in two different Russian prisons for theft and assault. The Interpol file tracked him until 2008, when he slipped into the United States illegally and never returned. It described him at that time as a six who was associated with a Minsk-based subset of the Russian Bratva, meaning Brotherhood, a
a general word encompassing all of Russian organized crime. The report stated that a six was a low-level mob associate used on the front line of criminal enterprises. The reference came from the lowest rank in a deck of cards used in a Russian game called the Sixes. Such associates were often used as enforcers until they showed leadership skills and were moved up to the position of bratok, or soldier. It appeared to Bosch that once he was in the United States, Sluchek started showing leadership skills and had moved Santos out of the picture in the California operation. He assumed that if the man pulled that morning from the Salton Sea was identified, he would have a history similar to Sluchek's. The report concluded that Sluchek was most likely still connected to the Bratva and reported to and contributed profits from the California operation to a pakhan, or boss, back in Minsk, who had been identified as Oleg Novichenko. Bosch closed the file and thought about the chain of events that resulted in the Esquivels being executed in their place of business and people like Elizabeth Clayton being literally enslaved in the desert. The seeds were planted thousands of miles away by faceless men of greed and violence. Bosch knew that people like Novichenko and the men between him and Sluchek would never pay for their crimes here, and that their operation, though down now, would rise again in another spot, with other Sixes stepping up and showing their leadership skills. The men who fired bullets into Jose Esquivel Jr. and his father were dead, but the justice gained was small. Bosch could not bring himself to take part in a press conference to laud the quick closing of the case. Some cases were never closed. Bosch put the file on a shelf behind his chair where he put the cases he believed he had worked to the extent of his ability and reach. He turned back to the desk and went to work on the computer, attempting to locate Dina Schuyler. Using the department computer to further his own private investigations had been forbidden when he had first come to work in San Fernando. But once he built an impressive record of closing cases, that rule was treated with a wink and a nod. Valdez and Trevino wanted to keep him happy and in the office as often as possible. The search didn't take long. Dina was still alive and still in L.A. She had gotten married, and her last name was now Rousseau. The address on her current driver's license placed her on Queens Road above the Sunset Strip. Bosch decided to go knock on her door. Part 3. The Intervention. Chapter 36. Bosch got to Union Station by 8:15 Wednesday morning. He parked in the short-term lot in front and went inside to wait for his daughter. Her train was only 10 minutes behind schedule, and when they connected in the vast central waiting area, she had no baggage with her and only carried a book. She explained that her plan was to take a train back down to San Diego after the court hearing, unless Bosch needed her to stay. They ate crepes, her choice, at the station for breakfast before crossing Alameda and walking through the plaza by the El Pueblo de Los Angeles on their way into the Civic Center. There, the monolithic criminal courts building stood like a tombstone at the top of a rise. They split up at the main entrance so Bosch could enter through the law enforcement pass-through because of his weapon. He showed his badge and made it through a solid 10 minutes ahead of Maddie, who had to inch her way through the metal detector at the public entrance in a long line. They made up for the lost time by hopping onto an employees-only elevator and riding up to the 9th floor in Department 107, the courtroom at the end of the hallway, where Judge John Houghton presided. The Preston Borders case was not scheduled to be called until 10 a.m., but Mickey Holler had told Bosch to get to court early so they could discuss last-minute details and maneuvers. Bosch appeared to be the first person on his team to arrive. He sat in the back row of the gallery with his daughter and watched the proceedings. Houghton, a veteran jurist with a shock of silver hair, was on the bench, going through a calendar call of other cases on his docket, getting updates and scheduling further hearings. There was also a video crew, setting up a pool camera in the jury box. Holler had told Bosch that so many local news stations had requested access to the hearing, following the Times story, that Houghton had specified that one randomly chosen crew could record the hearing and then share the video feed with the others. "Is he going to be here?" Maddie whispered. "Who?" Bosch asked. "Preston Borders." "Yes, he'll be here." He pointed to the metal door behind the desk where the courtroom deputy sat. He's probably in a holding cell back there now. Bosch realized by her first question that she might have a fascination with Borders, the unrepentant death row killer. He second-guessed his allowing his daughter to come. Bosch looked around. While Houghton was not the original judge on the Borders case, Department 107 was the original courtroom, and it looked to Bosch like it hadn't been updated in the intervening 30 years. It was 1960s contemporary design, like most of the courthouses in the county. Lightwood paneling covered the walls, with the judge's bench, witness stand, and clerk's corral all part of one module of sharp lines and faux wood. The great seal of the state of California was affixed to the wall at the front of the courtroom, 3 feet above the judge's head. The courtroom was cool, but Bosch felt hot under the collar of his suit. He tried to calm himself and be ready for the hearing. The truth was, he felt powerless. His career and reputation were essentially going to be in Mickey Haller's hands, and their fate possibly determined over the next few hours. As much as he trusted his half-brother, passing the responsibility to someone else left him sweating in a cold room. The first familiar face to enter the courtroom belonged to Cisco Wojciechowski. Bosch and his daughter slid down the bench, and the big man sat down. He was as dressed up as Bosch had ever seen him, in clean black jeans and matching boots, an untucked white-collared shirt, and a black vest with stylized swirls of silver thread. Bosch introduced his daughter, and then she went back to reading her book, a collection of essays by a writer named B.J. Novak. "How you feeling?" Cisco asked. "One way or another, it will all be over in a few hours," Bosch said. "How's Elizabeth?" "She had a rough night, but she's getting there. I got one of my guys watching her.
Maybe if you can, you could come by and see her.
Encourage her. Might help." "Sure, but when I was there yesterday, it looked like she wanted to use my head as a battering ram on the door." "You go through big changes in the first week. It will be different today. I think she's about to crest. It's an uphill battle, and then there's a point where you're suddenly going down the other side of the mountain." Bosch nodded. "The question is, what happens at the end of the week?" Cisco said. "Do we just cut her loose? Drop her off somewhere? She needs a long-range plan or she won't make it." "I'll think of something," Bosch said. "You just get her through the week, and I'll take it from there." "You sure?" "I'm sure." "Did you ever find out anything about the daughter? She still doesn't want to talk about it." "Yeah, I found out. Daisy. She was a runaway. Got into drugs in junior high, ran away from home. Was living on the street down in Hollywood, and one night she got in the wrong car with somebody. Shit. She was..." Bosch turned his body casually, as if he were reaching down with his left hand to adjust the cuff of his right pant leg. His back to his daughter, he continued. "Tortured, to put it politely, and left in a dumpster in an alley off of Cahuenga." Cisco shook his head. "I guess if anybody ever had a reason..." "Right. Did they at least catch the bastard?" "Nope. Not yet." Cisco laughed without humor. "Not yet," he said. "Like it's going to get solved 10 years later?" Bosch looked at him for a long moment without replying. "You never know," he said. Haller entered the courtroom then, saw his investigator and client sitting together, and pointed in the direction of the hallway outside. He hadn't noticed Maddie because the two bigger men had eclipsed her from the doorway angle. Bosch whispered to Maddie to stay where she was and started to get up. Maddie put her hand on his arm to stop him. "Who are you just talking about?" A woman from a case. She needed help, and I asked Cisco to get involved." "What kind of help? Who's Daisy?" "We can talk about it later. I need to go out and talk to your uncle about the hearing. Stay here and I'll be back." Bosch got up and followed Cisco out. Most people in the long hallway congregated down in the middle near the snack bar, restrooms, and elevators. Team Bosch found an open bench with some privacy by the door to Department 107 and sat down, Haller in the middle. "Okay, boys, are we ready to rock?" the lawyer said. "How are my witnesses?" "Where are my witnesses?" "Locked and loaded, I think," Cisco said. "Tell me about Spencer," Haller said. "You guys stayed with him, right?" "All night," Cisco said. "As of 20 minutes ago, he was still at his new lawyer's office in the Bradbury."
Bosch knew that meant Spencer was only 2 blocks away. Holler turned on the bench and looked at him eye to eye. And you? I told you to get some sleep, he said. But you still look like shit. And there's dust on the shoulders of that suit, man. Holler reached out and roughly slapped off the dust that had settled on the suit during the 2 or more years it had been on a hanger in Bosch's closet. I don't have to remind you, this is probably all going to come down to you, Holler said. Be sharp. Be forthright. These people are fucking with everything that is important to you.
I know that, Bosch said.
As if on cue, the CIU team came out of the stairwell down the hall, having taken steps down from the DA's office. It was Kennedy, Soto, and Tapscott. They were heading to Department 107. Another woman, who was carrying a cardboard file box with 2 hands, followed. She was most likely Kennedy's assistant. Further behind them, coming from the elevator alcove at the same time, walked Cronin and Cronin. Lance Cronin wore steel-rimmed glasses and had slicked back jet-black hair that was obviously dyed. His suit was black with pinstripes, and his tie a loud aqua. He looked like he went to great lengths to appear young, and the reason was right next to him, matching him stride for stride. Catherine Cronin was at least 20 years his junior. She had flowing red hair and a voluptuous figure, clad in a blue calf-length skirt and matching jacket over a chiffon blouse. Here they all come, Bosch said. Holler looked up from a yellow legal pad he was referring to and saw the opposition approaching. Like lambs to slaughter, he said, his voice brimming with bravado and confidence. Team Bosch remained seated as the others made the turn toward the courtroom door. Kennedy kept his eyes averted, as though there was no one sitting on the bench 15 feet away. But Soto locked eyes with Bosch and peeled off from her team to approach him. She was unhesitant about speaking in front of Holler and Wojciechowski.
Harry, why didn't you call me back? She asked. I left you several messages.
Because there was nothing to say, Lucia, Bosch said. You guys believe Borders over me, and there's nothing else to say.
I believe the forensic evidence, Harry. It doesn't mean I believe you planted the other evidence. The stuff in the paper didn't come from me.
Then how did the evidence I found get there, Lucia?
How did Danny Schuyler's pendant get into the suspect's apartment?
I don't know, but you weren't in there alone. So you're still willing to pass the buck to a dead guy?
I didn't say that. What I'm saying is that I don't need to know the answer to that.
Bosch stood up so he could speak to her face to face.
Yeah, well, see, that doesn't work for me, Lucia. You can't believe in the forensic evidence without believing that the other evidence was planted in the apartment. And that's why I didn't call you back.
She shook her head sadly and then turned away. Tapscott was holding the courtroom door open for her. He gave Bosch the dead-eye stare as Soto went by him. Bosch watched the door silently close behind them.
Look at this, Holler said.
Bosch looked down the hall and saw 2 women approaching. They were dressed for a night of clubbing, with black skirts cut to mid-thigh and patterned black stockings, one with skulls on them, the other crucifixes.
Groupies, Sisko said. If Borders walks out of here today, he'll probably be banging a different broad every night for a year.
The first 2 were followed by 3 more, dressed similarly and with tattoos and piercings to the max. Then from the elevator alcove came a woman in a pale yellow dress appropriate for court. Her blonde hair was tied back, and she walked with a hesitancy that suggested she had not been in a courthouse since the first trial 30 years before.
Is this Dina? Holler said.
That's her, Bosch said. When Bosch had visited her Monday night, he thought Dina Russo was beautiful and the image of what her sister might have grown to be. She had given up on acting when she got married to a studio executive and started a family. She told Bosch she had no doubt that Preston Borders had been her sister's killer and would not hesitate to tell a judge so or to appear in court simply as moral support. Holler and Sisko joined Bosch in standing as she approached, and Bosch introduced her.
We certainly appreciate your willingness to come here today and to testify if necessary, Holler said.
I couldn't live with myself if I didn't, she said.
I don't know if Detective Bosch told you this, Ms. Russo, but Borders will be in the courtroom today. He's been transported down from San Quentin for the hearing. I hope that this is not going to cause you any undue emotional distress.
Of course it will. But Harry told me that he would be here, and I'm ready. Just point me to where I need to go.
Sisko, why don't you take Miss Rousseau into the courtroom and sit with her? We still have a few minutes, and we're going to wait for our last witness. Sisko did as instructed, and that left Bosch and Holler standing in the hallway. Bosch pulled his phone and checked the time. They had 10 minutes until the hearing was scheduled to start. "Come on, Spencer, where are you?" Holler said. They both stared down the long hallway. Because the top of the hour was approaching, the crowds were thinning as people went into the various courtrooms for the start of hearings and trials. It left the space outside of court wide open. 5 minutes went by. No Spencer. "Okay," Holler said. "We don't need him. We'll work his absence to our advantage. He defied a valid subpoena. Let's go in and do this." He headed toward the courtroom door and Bosch followed, taking one last glance toward the elevator alcove before disappearing inside. Bosch saw that a number of reporters had slipped into the courtroom and were in the front row. He also saw that Sisko and Dina were in the last row, next to his daughter. Dina was staring toward the front of the courtroom, a growing look of horror on her face. Bosch followed the line of her vision and saw that Preston Borders was being led into the courtroom through the metal door that accessed the courthouse jail. Courtroom deputies were on either side of and behind him. He walked slowly toward the defense table. He was in leg and wrist shackles, with a heavy chain running up between his legs and connecting the bindings. He was wearing orange jail scrubs, the color given to jailhouse VIPs. Bosch had not seen Borders in person in nearly 30 years. Back then he had been a young man with a tan and 1980s actor hair, big, full, and wavy. Now he had a curved back, and his hair was gray and thin, matching papery skin that received sunlight only 1 hour a week. But he still had the flinty, dead-eyed stare of a psychopath. As he entered, he glanced out into the courtroom gallery and smiled at the groupies who longed to be held by those eyes. They were standing in a middle row, bouncing on their heels and trying to hold themselves back from squealing. Then his eyes went beyond them, and he found Bosch standing with Holler at the back. They were dark, sunken eyes, glowing like trash can fires in an alley at night, glowing with hate. Chapter 37. Once Borders was seated at the defense table between Lance and Catherine Cronin, the court clerk alerted Judge Houghton, and he emerged from his chambers and retook his seat on the bench. He scanned the courtroom, eyeing those at the front tables as well as those in the gallery. His eyes seemed to hold on Holler as a recognizable face. He then got down to work.
"Next on the docket, California versus Borders, a habeas matter, and motion to vacate set for evidentiary hearing," Houghton said. "Before proceeding, I want to make clear that the court expects the rules of decorum to be followed at all times. Any outburst from the gallery will result in the quick removal of the offending party."
As he spoke, Houghton was looking directly at the group of young women who had come to get a look at Borders. He then continued with the business at hand.
"We also have a motion to be heard that was filed on Friday by Mr. Holler, who I see in the back of the courtroom. Why don't you come up, Mr. Holler? Your client can take a seat in the gallery."
While Bosch slid into the row next to Sisko, his lawyer started up the center aisle toward the well of the courtroom. Before he even got to the gate, Kennedy was on his feet, objecting to Holler's motion on technical terms. He argued that the motion was filed too late in the game and was without merit. Lance Cronin stood and offered support to Kennedy's argument, adding his own description of Holler's motion.
"Your Honor, this is just a stunt by Mr. Holler to curry favor with the media," Cronin said. "As Mr. Kennedy aptly put it, this motion has no merit. Mr. Holler is simply looking for some free advertising at the expense of my client, who has suffered and waited for this day for 30 years.
Holler had pushed through the gate and moved to a lectern located between the two tables at the head of the room.
"Mr. Holler, I'm assuming you have a response to that," Houghton said.
"Indeed I do, Your Honor," Holler said.
"For the record, I am Michael Holler, representing Detective Hieronymus Bosch in this matter. May it please the court, my client has become aware of the petition for habeas corpus filed by Mr. Cronin and supported by the District Attorney's Office, alleging that Mr. Bosch falsified material evidence
used to convict Mr. Borders some 29 years ago. Inexplicably, he was not subpoenaed for this hearing or otherwise invited to attend and testify in answer to these allegations. And I note here for the record that these unfounded allegations made their way into the Los Angeles Times and were reported as fact, and therefore have irrevocably damaged his professional and personal reputation, as well as his livelihood.
Mr. Holla, we don't have all day, Houghton said. Make your argument.
Of course, Your Honor. My client fervently denies the allegations which impugn his integrity, good name, and reputation. He has testimony and evidence he wants to present that is relevant and material to the resolution of these issues. In short, this whole thing is a scam, Your Honor, and we can prove it, if given the opportunity. Hence, I have filed on my client's behalf a motion for leave to intervene, as well as a complaint answering the allegations against him. I have served notice to all parties, and it was most likely that service that resulted in the newspaper article mentioned earlier that trashed Mr. Bosch's good reputation and standing in the law enforcement community.
Your Honor, Kennedy cried,
the state objects to the malicious allegation made by Mr. Haller. The source of the newspaper story was certainly not my office or investigative team, as we attempted diligently to handle this in a manner least impactful to Mr. Bosch. The story came from somewhere else, and the state asks for sanctions against Mr. Haller.
Your Honor, Haller said calmly, I am willing to show clerk of the court records, and my client is willing to show his phone records, which together make it clear that within 2 hours of my filing motions Friday, the reporter for the Los Angeles Times was calling Mr. Bosch and asking for comment. My motions were filed under seal, and therefore copied only to the parties opposing Mr. Bosch right here, right now. You can draw your own conclusions, Judge. I have drawn mine.
Houghton swiveled in his high-backed leather chair for a moment before responding.
I think we've batted that back and forth enough, he said. There won't be any sanctions. Let's move this along, Mr. Holler. Both Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Cronin object to your client standing in this matter. How do you respond to that?
Holler banged a fist down on the lectern for emphasis before wading into the fray again.
How do I respond? He asked.
I'm incredulous, Your Honor. Sunday's newspaper dragged my client through the mud. It clearly implied that he planted evidence that sent a man away to death row. And here we are. And he was not even invited to the party? Given that the newspaper account and allegations contained in the state's petition implicate my client's property rights and reputation and good name, I believe he has standing to intervene and defend those rights. If that is not the correct vehicle, then I would suggest the alternative, that he be viewed as a friend of the court and be permitted to testify and adduce evidence relevant to the issues the court must weigh.
Houghton solicited responses from Kennedy and Cronin, but it became clear to Bosch that the judge found it difficult not to give him his day in court after his name and reputation were called into question by the Times and by the details of the original petitions, which the DA's office did not seek to seal from public view. Kennedy became frustrated when he made the same read on the judge's words and demeanor as Bosch had.
Your Honor, the state can't be held responsible for an article in the newspaper, he said. We were not the source of the story. If we made a mistake in not asking for our motion to be sealed, then okay, that is on us. But it's surely not enough of an infraction to warrant this intervention by Bosch. There is a man sitting in this courtroom who has been on death row for more than 10,000 days. Yes, I did the math. And it is our duty as officers of the court to make that injustice our priority today.
That is, if it's an injustice, Holler said quickly.
The evidence we seek to present tells a different story, Your Honor. It's the story of a scam carried out by cunning minds and perpetrated on the citizenry as well as on Mr. Kennedy and his office.
I'm going to take 10 minutes to refer to the code, and then we'll reconvene, Houghton said. Nobody go far. 10 minutes.
The judge was up and off the bench quickly, and he disappeared into the hallway behind the clerk's corral that led to his chambers. Bosch liked that about Houghton. He had been in trials with the judge in the past, and knew he was very assured as a courtroom referee, but he wasn't conceited enough to assume he knew every nuance of the law as written. He was willing to call a quick time out, to check the code books, so that when he made a ruling, it had the solid backing of the law. Holler turned around and looked at Bosch.
He pointed toward the rear door of the courtroom, and Bosch understood that he was still wondering about Spencer. It was a sign that Holler was confident that the judge's ruling was going to go his way. Bosch got up and walked out of the courtroom to check on Spencer. The hallway was practically deserted now, and there was no sign of him. Bosch went back into the courtroom. The sound of the door drew Holler's attention, and Bosch shook his head. The judge returned to the bench a minute early and immediately shot down a request from Kennedy to provide further argument. He then proceeded with his ruling. Although the statute and rules governing habeas procedure are within the penal code, it's axiomatic that such a petition is in the nature of a civil action. Hence, an intervener under civil rules would seem to be appropriate. Detective Bosch's property, right in his good name and reputation, is an interest that he is entitled and permitted to protect, and that is, to the court's observation and research, not being protected by the existing parties to this action. So I grant the motion for leave to intervene. Mr. Holler, you can call your first witness. Kennedy, who had inexplicably remained standing after his last objection was denied, quickly objected again. Your Honor, this is unfair, he said. We are not prepared for witnesses. The state requests that we carry this over 30 days in order to seek depositions and prepare for a hearing. Cronin stood as well. Bosch expected him to protest any postponement, but instead he seconded the request. Bosch thought he saw Kennedy wince. It was probably at that moment that the prosecutor knew he had somehow been played by Cronin, or Borders, or both.
What happened to the 10,000 days Mr. Kennedy mentioned earlier? Houghton said. The travesty of justice? Now you want to send the man whom your petition exonerates back to death row for another 30 days? We all know that with court calendars being what they are, there is no 30-day delay. Putting this off for 30 days might as well be 90, because my calendar is that far out. I'm not seeing a reason to delay these proceedings, gentlemen.
Houghton swiveled in his chair again and looked down from the bench at Borders.
Mr. Borders? Are you willing to go back up to San Quentin for another 3 months while the attorneys get into this?
There was a long moment before Borders responded, and Bosch savored every second of it. There was no good answer for Borders. To accept the delay would be to reveal, as his attorney just had, that there was something wrong here. To say he did not accept his own attorney's wish for a delay would be to invite Holler to trot his witnesses to the stand and risk the whole scam being exposed.
I just want to get it right, Borders finally said. I've been up there a long time. I don't suppose a little more time matters, if it means they get it right.
That's exactly what the court is trying to do here, Houghton said. Get it right.
Bosch caught movement in his peripheral vision and turned to see the courtroom door opening. A man in a suit, who he presumed was a lawyer, entered and was followed by Terry Spencer. They stepped in and surveyed the courtroom, and the soft bang of the door closing behind them drew the rest of the eyes in the courtroom to them. Bosch turned to check that Holler saw that their witness had arrived. Then he looked at the faces of the defense table. Borders showed minimal interest in the new arrivals, because he didn't know Spencer by sight. But the reactions of the Cronin legal team was telling. Lance Cronin pursed his lips and blinked. He looked like a chess player who knew three moves out that he had lost. Catherine Cronin's reaction went beyond surprise. She looked like she was seeing a ghost. Her jaw went slack and her eyes turned from the man standing at the back of the courtroom to her husband, sitting on the other side of their client. Bosch read fear in them. Bosch's eyes then hunted through the rows of benches in the gallery for Lucia Soto. He found her in the front row by the courtroom deputy's desk. It was clear that she recognized Spencer, but she had a puzzled look on her face. She genuinely wasn't sure why the man from property control was in the courtroom. May I make a suggestion to the court? The words came from Holler, and they drew all attention away from Spencer.
Go ahead, Mr. Holler, Houghton said.
What if all the lawyers and principals continue the hearing in camera? Holler said. I will give Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Cronin a verbal proffer for each witness I intend to call, and for each document and video I plan to introduce. They will then be better informed on whether to seek a delay or not. The reason I asked to move to chambers is that I would want to be shielded from the media should I not be 100% accurate in my proffers.
How long will this take, Mr. Holler? The judge asked.
I'll be quick. I think I can do it in 15 minutes or less.
I like your idea, Mr. Holler, but we have a problem. I'm not sure if I have room in chambers for all attorneys and their clients, as well as Mr. Kennedy and his investigators. Additionally, we have a security issue with Mr. Borders, and I don't think our courthouse deputies want him moved around the building. So what I am going to do is use the courtroom for a closed in-camera conference and ask that witnesses, members of the media, and all other observers leave for 15 minutes so we can hear your proffers, Mr. Holler.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The pool camera can stay, but it needs to be turned off. Deputy Garza, please call for an additional deputy who can stand outside the door in the hallway until we are ready to invite the public back in.
There was a commotion as several people stood at once to leave the courtroom. Bosch sat still at first, just admiring the genius of Holler's move, because he was giving the judge a summary of what would be shown and testified to. There would be no oaths taken, and therefore no consequences for any exaggerations or untruths that might be exposed later. Holler was about to get a free swing at the case against Bosch, and there was nothing Kennedy and the Cronins could do about it.
Chapter 38. Holler signaled Bosch to the front. He went through the gate and took a seat against the railing. He looked around and saw he was only about 6 feet from where Borders sat shackled between Cronin and Cronin. Two deputies were in chairs directly behind him. He looked to the rear of the courtroom and saw people still bunched at the door and moving out. His daughter was last in line and looking back at him. She gave him a nod of confidence, and he returned it. After she moved through the doorway, he returned his attention to Borders. He made a low whistle sound, and it caught Borders' ear. The man in orange turned and looked directly at Bosch. Bosch winked. Borders looked away. Holler stepped over and blocked Bosch's view of him.
Don't worry about him, he said. Stay focused on what's important.
He took the empty seat next to Bosch and leaned into him to whisper.
I'm going to try to get you on the record, he said. No proffer from me. You. So remember, be forthright, act outraged.
I told you, not a problem, Bosch said. Holler turned to check the back of the room.
Did you talk to Spencer or Daly before they left?
No. Is Daly the lawyer?
Yeah, Dan Daly. He's usually a federal court guy. Must be slumming today, or he previously knew Spencer. I'll put Cisco on it.
Holler took out his phone and started typing a text to his investigator, who had been among those invited by the judge to leave the courtroom. Bosch stood up so he'd have an angle on the screen. Holler was telling Cisco to see if Daly would reveal what Spencer was willing to testify to. He told Cisco to text him back. Just as he sent the message off, Houghton called the courtroom back to order.
Okay, we're going to be on the record here, but this is a case management conference of the related parties present, not part of the official hearing record. What is said here is not to go outside the courtroom. Mr. Holler, why don't you walk us through what you plan to do with your witnesses and documents if your motion is granted, and let's be brief.
Holler stood up and went to the lectern, placing a legal pad down. Bosch could see that the top page was covered in notes, several of which were circled with arrows, pointing to other circles. It was a schematic of the frame against Bosch. Beneath the pad, he had a file containing the documents he would put before the judge.
Thank you for this opportunity, Your Honor, he began. You won't regret it.
Because Mr. Cronin and Mr. Kennedy are correct, there has been a miscarriage of justice here, just not the one most people think has occurred.
Your Honor, Kennedy said, holding his hands, palms out, and up in a what-is-going-on gesture.
Mr. Holler, Houghton said, if I may draw your eyes to the jury box to your left, you will see it is empty. I said be brief. I didn't say make a statement to a non-existent jury.
Yes, Your Honor, Holler said. Thank you.
Moving on, then. The District Attorney's Conviction Integrity Unit took on this case, and in a forensic review of the evidence, found DNA on the clothing of Danielle Schuyler that did not come from her convicted killer, Preston Borders. Instead, it came from a now-deceased serial rapist named Lucas John Ulmer.
Mr. Holler, Houghton interrupted again, you are reciting the known facts of the matter before the court.
I granted you entrance to the case as an intervener. An intervention requires something new, a change in direction. Do you have that or not?
I do, Haller said.
Then get to it. Don't tell the court what it already knows.
What I have that's new is this. Detective Bosch can show, through documentation and sworn testimony, that Lucas John Ulmer's DNA was planted in the evidence box in LAPD property control as part of an elaborate scheme to set Preston Borders free and realize millions of dollars in damages from a false conviction. Houghton held a handout to stay Kennedy from an obvious objection.
A scheme by whom, Mr. Haller? Houghton asked. Are you saying that Preston Borders on death row at San Quentin orchestrated this?
No, Your Honor, Haller said. I'm saying Preston Borders bought into it because he had no other shot left at freedom. But the scheme was orchestrated right here in Los Angeles by the law firm of Cronin and Cronin. Immediately, Lance Cronin was on his feet.
I strenuously object to this charade, he said. Mr. Haller is besmirching my good reputation with this insidious accusation, when it is his client who...
Noted, Mr. Cronin, Houghton said, cutting off Cronin in mid-paroxysm. But let me remind you that we are in a closed session here, and nothing offered by counsel will reach the ears of the public. But then the judge turned his attention to Haller.
You are making a very strong allegation, Mr. Haller, he said. You need to put up or shut up.
I'll be putting up, Haller said, right now. Haller briefly outlined the essential contradiction of the case, as Bosch had expressed to Soto in the hallway. If the DNA found in evidence was legit, then the seahorse found during the search of Preston Borders' apartment was not. It was an either-or proposition. Our position is that the seahorse pendant was, and always has been, the true evidence of the case, Haller said. It is the DNA from Lucas John Ulmer that was planted. And before outlining how that occurred, I would ask the court to indulge me and allow my client to speak to this matter of planting evidence. He has spent more than 40 years in law enforcement, and it is his good name and reputation that are at stake here. Both Kennedy and Cronin stood and objected to Bosch's being allowed to enter testimony without cross-examination. Houghton quickly made a decision.
We are not going to go down that road in this conference, he said. If we get back in open court, and on the record, the court will entertain that. I will say this, however. Detective Bosch has appeared in this courtroom many times over the years, while I have had the honor to serve on the bench, and his integrity has never been called into question, until now.
Bosch nodded his thanks for the slim measure of support from the judge.
Proceed, Mr. Haller, Houghton said.
Moving on, then, Haller said as he opened the file he had on the lectern. It is known to the court and all parties here that Mr. Cronin represented Lucas John Ulmer in the case that resulted in his imprisonment until the time of his death 16 months ago. Key evidence in that case was DNA evidence connecting Ulmer to a series of sexual assaults for which he was charged. I submit to the court now a copy of a court order taken from the record of that case requiring prosecutors to split DNA evidence with the defense for private testing. Kennedy stood to object.
Your Honor, if counsel is trying to insinuate that Ulmer's DNA was handed to Cronin so that he could secrete some of it for himself to use years later in a scheme to free a man from death row, then that is ridiculously offensive. As Mr. Haller certainly knows, Mr. Cronin would not have come near that material. Chain of evidence protocol would require a secure lab-to-lab transfer. Mr. Haller is blowing smoke and wasting the court's time.
Haller shook his head and smiled before defending himself.
Blowing smoke, Your Honor? We will see who is blowing smoke. I am not suggesting that there was anything untoward in the lab-to-lab transfer before Ulmer's trial. But at trial, the DNA was not ultimately challenged, as the defense chose to claim that the sex acts were consensual. The DNA matching was even stipulated to by the defense. The evidentiary record, however, is not complete post-trial. According to Mr. Kennedy's vaunted protocol, all genetic materials not used in the private lab's analysis were to be returned after trial to the custody of the LAPD lab. There is no record of any material being returned. It's missing, Your Honor.
and was last in the hands of a lab working for Mr. Cronin. Now it was Cronin's turn to stand up and protest.
This is ridiculous, Judge. I never had that material, and I wouldn't know if the lab returned it or not. To have to sit here and have this sort of allegation.
Again, we are in closed session here, Houghton said. Let's stay on point, Mr. Haller. What else do you have?
I have a few more documents here I would like to tender to the court, Haller said. The first is a letter from Deputy City Attorney Cecil French that confirms that the city has received a complaint for damages from Preston Borders regarding what he says is his false imprisonment for murder following a corrupt investigation by the LAPD. The complaint was filed by Lance Cronin, attorney at law. The amount of damages being sought is not listed because they never are this early in the game. But common sense dictates that a man allegedly framed for murder by a city employee and sent to death row for almost 3 decades would be seeking millions of dollars in damages. Cronin started to stand again, but Houghton held up a hand like a traffic cop, and the lawyer slowly sank back down to his seat. Haller continued. Additionally, he said, we have here a copy of the visitor log from San Quentin that shows Lance Cronin has made regular visits to Preston Borders beginning in January of last year.
He is his attorney, Houghton said.
Is there something sinister about an attorney visiting a client in prison, Mr. Haller? Not at all, Your Honor. But in order to visit a death row inmate, you must be his attorney of record. Mr. Cronin became that as of January of last year, several months before he sent the letter to the Conviction Integrity Unit, allegedly clearing his conscience about Ulmer's confession to him.
Bosch almost smiled. The timing of Cronin's beginnings with Borders was proof of nothing, but it certainly smacked of collusion, and the way Haller had walked the judge right into it was perfect. Bosch put his arm up on the empty chair next to him, so he could casually glance to his right at Soto and Tapscott. They looked like they were seriously tracking the story Haller was spinning.
Additionally, Haller said, if the motion to intervene is granted, Detective Bosch is prepared to present witnesses who contradict the key elements of the petitioner's habeas motion. To wit, the petitioner throws the reputation of his trial attorney, Mr. David Siegel, to the wolves, saying that the late Mr. Siegel suborned Mr. Borders' perjury at trial by telling him to testify that the key piece of evidence found in his apartment, the seahorse pendant, was not the victim's, but a facsimile he bought on the Santa Monica Pier.
And you have a witness who contradicts that testimony? Houghton asked.
I do, Your Honor, Haller said. I have Mr. David Siegel himself, who is willing to contradict the report of his own death, as well as the contention that he suborned perjury from his client at the trial in 1988. He is willing to testify that the entire testimony given by Mr. Borders was concocted by Mr. Borders himself in an attempt to explain away the damning evidence that he was in possession of the victim's jewelry.
Kennedy and Cronin were both quickly to their feet, but Cronin spoke first.
Your Honor, this is absurd, he said. Even if it is proven that David Siegel is alive, his testimony would be a flagrant violation of attorney-client privilege and completely inadmissible.
Judge, I beg to differ with Mr. Cronin, Haller said. Attorney-client privilege was wholly shattered by Mr. Borders when he revealed the inner workings of his trial strategy and sought to impugn the good name and reputation of his attorney in his petition, much as he maligned my client, Detective Bosch. I have in my possession a video proffer, an interview with Mr. Siegel 7 days ago that shows him to be alive and sound of mind and defending himself against the slander perpetrated by Mr. Borders and his attorney.
Haller reached into his pocket and produced a digital storage stick containing the video in question. He held it up above his head, drawing all eyes in the courtroom to it. The judge hesitated and then pulled the stemmed microphone closer. Cronin and Kennedy sat back down.
Mr. Haller, Houghton said, we're going to hold off on your video for the time being. The court finds it intriguing, but your 15 minutes are just about up, and this matter comes down to one thing. Ulmer's DNA was found on the victim's clothing, and there seems to be no dispute about that.
That clothing had been sealed in evidence archives for years. Years before Mr. Ulmer went to trial, and Mr. Cronin may or may not have come into possession of his genetic material. Years before Mr. Cronin ever met Mr. Borders, and years before Mr. Ulmer died in prison. Do you have an answer for that? Because if you don't, then it's time to move on to a ruling on this matter. Holler nodded and looked down at his legal pad. Bosch caught a glimpse of Kennedy in profile and thought he was smirking, no doubt because he believed Holler had no answer for the DNA's being in the archive box. The court is correct, Holler then began. We do not dispute the finding of DNA on the victim's clothing. Detective Bosch, and I also, have the utmost belief in the integrity of the LAPD lab. We do not suggest that the results of the analysis are to be doubted. It is our belief that the DNA from Ulmer was planted on the clothing prior to its being turned over to the lab. Kennedy jumped up again and hotly objected to the implication that there was corruption in either the property control section of the LAPD or the two detectives who reworked the case for CIU. The moves by Detectives Soto and Tapscott were well documented and above board, Kennedy said. Knowing that desperate people sometimes make desperate claims, they went so far as to video their unsealing of the evidence box themselves in order to document that no tampering had taken place. Holler jumped in before the judge could respond. Exactly, he said. They videoed the whole thing. And if it may please the court, I would like to play that video as part of my proffer. I have it queued up and ready to go on my laptop, Your Honor. I ask for the court's indulgence in extending my time. I can hook up my computer to the screen very quickly. He gestured toward the video screen on the wall opposite the jury box. There was a silence as Houghton considered the request, even as others in the courtroom were probably considering how Holler got a copy of the video. Bosch saw Soto sneak a sideways glance at him. He knew he was breaking their unspoken rule of confidentiality. She had not shared the video with him so he could use it in court. "Set it up, Mr. Holler," Houghton said. "I'll consider it part of the proffer." Holler turned from the lectern and grabbed his briefcase, which was on the floor in front of the chair next to Bosch. As he opened the briefcase on the chair and retrieved his laptop, he spoke under his breath to Bosch. "This is it," he said. "Like lambs to slaughter, right?" Bosch whispered. 5 minutes later, Holler had the video playing on the wall screen. Everyone in the courtroom, including those who had already seen the video multiple times, watched with rapt attention. It ended without reaction from the judge or anyone else. Holler then passed out copies of an 8x10 screen grab from the video to all the parties and the judge, then returned to the lectern. "I'm going to play the video again, but what you have in front of you is a screen grab from the 1:11 mark," he said. He started replaying the video and then stopped it, freezing the screen on the moment that Terrence Spencer could be seen watching the two detectives from the next room. Holler now pulled a pen-sized laser pointer from the inside pocket of his suit jacket and circled the image of Spencer with a glowing red dot. "This man, what is he doing? Just watching? Or does he have an interest that goes beyond curiosity?" Kennedy stood once again. "Your Honor, counsel's flights of fancy are getting ridiculous. The video clearly shows the box was not tampered with. So what does he do? He tries to draw the eye away from what is obvious to something and someone who clearly works in the property control unit and would have a vested interest in monitoring the unsealing of evidence. Can we please move on from this charade and get to the sad business of correcting a severe miscarriage of justice?" "Mr. Holler," Houghton said, "my patience is also wearing thin. Your Honor, if allowed to continue, my proffer will be completed in the next 5 minutes," Holler said. "Very well," Houghton said. "Continue. With speed." "Thank you. As I was asking before being interrupted, what is this man doing?" "Well, we got curious and tried to find out. As it happens, Detective Bosch recognized this man as a longtime employee of the property control unit. His name is Terrence Spencer. We decided to look into Mr. Spencer, and what we found out may startle the court." Holler took another document from his file
and glanced over at Lance Cronin as he delivered it to the clerk, who in turn delivered it to the judge. While the judge was looking at it, Bosch saw Holler step back behind the lectern and use it as a blind as he pulled his phone from his pocket, held it down by his hip, and read a text message that was on the screen. Bosch knew it was most likely the message from Cisco about Spencer that Holler had been waiting for. Holler dropped the phone back into his pocket and continued to address the judge. What we found was that 7 years ago, Terrence Spencer almost lost his house in a foreclosure. It was a bad time in this country, and a lot of people were in the same boat. Spencer got upside down, couldn't make double mortgage payments, and the banks had lost patience. And he would have lost his house if it had not been for the efforts of his foreclosure attorney, Kathy Zeldin, whom many of us in this courtroom now know as Kathy Cronin. Bosch could literally feel the air in the courtroom go still. Houghton went from slouching in his luxurious leather chair to coming forward and leaning intently over the bench. He was holding up the document Holler had provided and intently scanning it as Holler continued. Zeldin, now Cronin, saved Spencer's house at the time, he said. But all she really did was put off the inevitable. She put Spencer into a hard money refi that carried a massive $500,000 balloon payment due in 7 years. Due, I should say, to a privately held investment fund that controlled whether or not Spencer could sell his property in an effort to get out from beneath the balloon. They chose to prevent the house's sale because they knew it would come to them in foreclosure this summer. Well, poor Terry Spencer had no way out. He didn't have a $500,000 and had no way to get it. He couldn't even sell his house because the mortgage holder wouldn't allow it. So what does he do? He calls up his old lawyer, now a full partner in Cronin and Cronin, and says, what am I going to do? And Your Honor, from that point on, a conspiracy began. A conspiracy to defraud the district attorney's office and frame my client for planting evidence. All in an effort to free Preston Borders and collect a multi-million dollar settlement from the city of Los Angeles. Lance Cronin stood up, ready to argue. Kennedy was hesitantly rising, but the judge held up his hand to stop all from speaking and looked squarely at Holler. Mr. Holler, he intoned, those are very significant allegations. Do you plan to offer any evidence to go with them if I allow you to present this in open court? Yes, Your Honor, Holler said. The last witness I would present is Terrence Spencer himself. We were able to locate him over the weekend, hiding out at a home down in Laguna Beach that happens to be owned by the Cronins. I had him served with a subpoena. And at this moment, he's out in the hallway with my investigator and ready to take the stand. Chapter 39. The threat of Terrence Spencer's testimony seemed to momentarily freeze things in the courtroom. Then it was Preston Borders who broke the silence with laughter. It started low and soon became a headback, full-throated burst of mirthless irony. He then cut it off, as if with the blade of a knife, and spoke to his lawyer with a deadly snarl in his voice. You fucking moron. You said this would work. You said it was foolproof. Borders tried to stand, but forgot that the lead chain between his legs had been clamped to his seat. He rose with the seat still awkwardly attached to him, and then dropped back down. Get me out of here. Just take me back. Cronin tried to huddle in close in order to silence his client. Get the fuck away from me, asshole. I'm gonna tell them everything, your whole fucking plan. Kennedy rose then, seeing the only path he could take. There was a stunned look on his face. Your Honor, at this time the state wishes to withdraw its motions in this matter, he said. The state now opposes the habeas petition. I'm sure it does, the judge said. But you can take your seat for the moment, Mr. Kennedy. Houghton turned his attention to the other table, specifically to Borders, instead of the two lawyers who flanked him. Mr. Borders, he said.
As you have seen, your petition for habeas corpus is no longer uncontested. It is opposed now by the district attorney and the lead detective on the case. Furthermore, you have just expressed what I take as a desire to discharge your lawyer and abandon these proceedings.